This is your strategic briefing for today. I'm coming to you with analysis on a fundamental shift that's crystallizing before our eyes. Russia has just broken what's being called an energy ceasefire, one that was reportedly requested at the highest levels of the US government. Meanwhile, the Western consensus on China has transformed from hopeful engagement to systemic competition. And beneath it all, domestic political fault lines are deepening in ways that will constrain America's strategic options. Let's break down what's actually happening and what it means for the global order. Let me start with Russia's calculated gamble. Moscow has violated an energy ceasefire that the US president personally requested, launching attacks on Ukrainian energy infrastructure in the dead of winter. This isn't just tactical opportunism. This is a strategic signal. What Russia is telling us is that military pressure on the battlefield matters more than preserving diplomatic channels with Washington, even with a new administration that campaigned on different engagement rhetoric. The timing here is deliberate. Strike when energy attacks inflict maximum humanitarian damage. Strike when European resolve faces its annual winter test. And perhaps most importantly, strike to establish the boundaries of what this new American administration will actually tolerate versus what it said on the campaign trail. Now, President Trump's response has been notably measured, suggesting something important. Despite all the campaign rhetoric about rapid policy change, we're seeing institutional continuity on Ukraine policy. This tells us that the deep state narrative misses something crucial. There are structural constraints on how quickly any administration can pivot on major strategic commitments, regardless of the president's personal preferences. The foreign policy establishment, congressional oversight, alliance commitments, and bureaucratic momentum create boundaries that limit rapid transformation. But here's what should concern strategic planners more than the ceasefire violation itself. We're seeing accumulating evidence of Russian economic fragility that contradicts the Kremlin's carefully constructed narrative of sanctions resilience. Putin himself has acknowledged inflation running at 9.4% annualized. But the real story is what's happening in Russia's sub-Arctic regions, where utility failures are becoming widespread. When you combine this with reports of a domestic fuel train explosion, you're looking at infrastructure vulnerabilities that extend well beyond military supply chains into the civilian economy's essential functions. The strategic calculus here is clear. Russia is trading long-term economic sustainability for short-term battlefield gains. This gamble rests on two critical assumptions. First, that Western resolve will fragment over time as economic costs mount and public attention wanes. Second, that alternative partnerships, particularly the deepening relationship with China, can offset Western sanctions pressure indefinitely. Both of these assumptions need continuous stress testing, because if either proves false, Russia's strategic position deteriorates rapidly. Which brings us to the China factor, and this is where the strategic picture gets considerably more complex. We're seeing reports of Chinese assistance in expanding Russian ballistic missile capabilities. This is an opportunistic alignment between two countries that happen to oppose American hegemony. This is systematic military-technical integration that fundamentally complicates Western containment strategies across multiple domains simultaneously. When China helps Russia enhance its precision strike capabilities, Beijing is investing in Moscow's ability to tie down Western military resources and political attention in Eastern Europe. This creates strategic space for Chinese operations in the Indo-Pacific. It's strategic coordination at a sophisticated level. Now, let me share something that captures just how dramatically Western strategic thinking has shifted. A former Canadian prime minister recently acknowledged that a decade ago, he assessed the probability of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan at essentially zero. Today, he's publicly stating there are real near-term risks. This evolution isn't one person's changing assessment. It reflects a broader transformation across Western security establishments. The foundational assumption that guided policy for three decades, the idea that economic integration would gradually liberalize China and bind it into the existing international order, that assumption has collapsed. The framework that's replacing it uses Hong Kong as the baseline case study. When China violated its international commitments on Hong Kong's autonomy, despite the legal framework of the Sino-British Joint Declaration, it demonstrated that Beijing will breach agreements when the domestic political imperative outweighs international reputation costs. This reframing has profound implications. If China violated commitments on Hong Kong when the costs were relatively modest, what does that tell us about Taiwan, where Beijing views reunification as a core interest tied to regime legitimacy? What does it mean for South China Sea commitments, technology transfer agreements, or WTO obligations? The policy response taking shape is what's being called smart globalization, not complete deglobalization, which would be economically catastrophic, but strategic supply chain redundancy that avoids dependence on adversarial powers for critical inputs. Over the next decade, this will reshape global manufacturing footprints, technology supply chains, and trade architecture. Companies will need to maintain parallel supply chains, even when it's economically inefficient, because the risk of coercive cutoff outweighs the cost savings. But here's the vulnerability that's been exposed in stark terms. The Australia case study shows Western susceptibility to divide-and-conquer tactics. When China imposed punishing economic measures on Australia for calling for a COVID origin investigation, most Western allies offered rhetorical support but little substantive coordination. Individual nations simply cannot counter Chinese economic coercion alone. The emphasis now on G7 coordination and mechanisms like the International Democrat Union reflect belated recognition that the coming competition requires institutional frameworks beyond ad hoc bilateral arrangements. The question is whether these coordination mechanisms can achieve sufficient cohesion before China tests them in a crisis. Now let's turn to the domestic American political landscape, because what happens in Washington will fundamentally constrain or enable U.S. strategic options globally. We're approaching potential inflection points that could reshape federal-state relations and legislative capacity. There's serious discussion about eliminating the Senate filibuster, which would allow the majority party to pass legislation with simple majorities rather than the 60-vote threshold. This might sound like procedural inside baseball, but the implications are profound. It would enable rapid legislative transformation on everything from immigration enforcement to fiscal policy to federal-state power dynamics. Consider the emerging constitutional tension around sanctuary cities. The argument being advanced is that if states can be penalized for obstructing federal immigration enforcement, and if local officials can face criminal penalties for noncompliance, you're establishing legal precedents that apply far beyond immigration. This framework could reshape federalism itself, affecting firearms regulation, environmental policy, and dozens of other domains where federal and state authority overlap or conflict. Here's where it gets even more interesting from a geopolitical intelligence perspective. There are reports, disputed but circulating in policy circles, of organized, well-funded resistance to ICE operations with alleged CCP-aligned funding. Whether these reports were substantiated or not almost doesn't matter at this point, because the perception is driving policy responses and hardening factional positions. Immigration enforcement is becoming a proxy battlefield in great power competition, at least in the minds of key decision makers. But underlying all of this is the fiscal reality that nobody wants to confront directly. The United States is carrying $39 trillion in debt, with annual deficits projected at $2.6 trillion. To put that in perspective, that's larger than the entire GDP of most countries, and we're having these projections during a period of relatively strong economic growth and low unemployment. What happens when the next recession hits? There's also increasing attention on what some are calling the NGO industrial complex, $14.1 trillion in assets across the nonprofit sector, raising questions about capital allocation, transparency, and whether these entities are serving their stated missions or have become self-perpetuating bureaucracies. The strategic concern here is that massive capital is being deployed in ways that may not align with national interests, sometimes explicitly opposing government policy while enjoying tax advantage status. Even within the Republican Party, which now controls both chambers of Congress and the presidency, there are deep tensions on spending discipline. Defense modernization to counter China requires sustained investment. European security commitments demand resources. Domestic infrastructure is crumbling. Technology competition in artificial intelligence, quantum computing, and biotechnology requires massive capital deployment. All of these compete for resources in an environment where bond markets may eventually impose the discipline that politics cannot or will not. So let me walk you through three scenarios that strategic planners should be modeling. I'm going to give you probability assessments, but understand these are inherently uncertain and depend on key variables we'll identify. Scenario 1, managed decoupling. I assess this at about 40% probability. In this trajectory, Western allies achieve sufficient coordination to implement supply chain diversification while maintaining reasonable economic growth. Russia remains bogged down in Ukraine without achieving decisive victory. China focuses on domestic economic stabilization rather than risky Taiwan action. U.S. fiscal discipline improves marginally through AI-enabled efficiency gains and modest entitlement reforms that don't require massive political capital. This is the muddling-through scenario. Not elegant, not inspiring, but potentially stable. Scenario 2. Fragmentation cascade. 35% probability. Western alliance cohesion fractures under sustained Chinese economic pressure and sophisticated divide-and-conquer tactics. Russia achieves a frozen conflict in Ukraine on terms favorable to Moscow, demonstrating that Western support has limits and timelines. U.S. domestic polarization prevents coherent strategic response. Fiscal crisis forces defense retrenchment at precisely the wrong moment. And China perceives a window of opportunity and moves on Taiwan within this period of Western disarray. This is the scenario that keeps strategists awake at night. Scenario 3. Controlled escalation. 25% probability. Military incidents in the Taiwan Strait or in Ukraine escalate beyond local containment. Cyber attacks on critical infrastructure blur the traditional distinctions between war and peace. Financial warfare accelerates through asset seizures and payment system fragmentation. In this scenario, alliance cohesion actually strengthens in crisis, as external threats often do forge unity, but the economic costs are massive and the risk of miscalculation leading to broader conflict is severe. So what are the key variables you should be tracking to assess which trajectory we're on? First, Chinese military exercises and gray zone pressure around Taiwan. Watch the frequency, the scope, and how close they come to Taiwan's territorial waters. Each iteration establishes new normals and test responses. Second, Russian economic indicators beyond the official statistics that Moscow publishes. Look for utility failures, wage arrears in specific regions, and localized protests over economic conditions. These are harder to manipulate than aggregate statistics.
Third, Western coordination mechanisms. Do G7 statements translate into coordinated action, or are they just communiques that gather dust? Fourth, U.S. legislative productivity in the first 100 days of this new administration. Does unified government control actually deliver legislative results, or do internal factions prevent coherent action? And finally, bond market responses to U.S. fiscal trajectory. Watch the 10-year yields and the composition of foreign holders. If major holders start reducing positions, that's your early warning signal that market discipline is coming. Here's your immediate monitoring priority for the next 48 hours. Watch for any Chinese military movements or exercises near Taiwan. We're entering a period where Beijing may test the new American administration's responses and coordination with regional allies. Any significant activity will tell us about Chinese strategic patience or impatience. The strategic realignment is no longer theoretical. It's here. The era of engagement is over. The era of competition has begun. The question now is whether the West can coordinate effectively enough to manage this transition without catastrophic escalation or economic fragmentation. Stay vigilant. Until tomorrow.